car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello and welcome back. This is The Thing About Cars. We are recording, as always, in Strongbox West. Around the table, we still have...
Leanne.
And...
Ben.
And...
Becca.
And I'm Mickey. Let's just jump right into our topics on the board that remain up here. At the top of the list is headlight restoration kits. And I was reading something online that ranked like the top 10 restoration kits. I didn't know if you guys had used one or had any favorites among them or...
I've used one.
Yeah?
Well, I did all those little things where I was testing out the DIY do-it-yourself it at home kind of toothpaste, what have you, and nothing was working on the headlights that I was trying to restore. So I did end up buying a kit that did a pretty fabulous job.
So wait a minute. When you did it at home with toothpaste, how did you do it?
Well, do you remember there was a whole conversation online? I know that doesn't help the people listening. I tried it in a various... I tried toothpaste. I tried it with a cloth. I tried it with a toothbrush.
Did you use the whitening version?
Yes, I think at some point that was involved. I can't even remember. And I had tried doing a vlog, and Ben was pointing out, oh, you can't do it that way. It's like, look, I was trying to shorten the blog because it was getting a little out of hand. But yeah, nothing was working. And I tried this on my husband's car because I wasn't going to try it on mine. Nail polish remover on your headlights.
Ooh, yeah, that could just be a problem. It totally screwed him up, didn't
Basically
it?
Basically acetone, right?
Yeah, it's just acetone.
Yeah, by the car paint, if you were to, I don't know, spill something. I don't know.
Right.
Which I didn't. I didn't. It did help some. But his headlights were not nearly as bad or as old as the ones that
so
I got a hold of.
I'm gloating a little bit in the notion that the one that I bought and used is in the top five of this list. And what I'm looking at is autoguide.com, and they list their top 10 favorites, including an editor's choice, which doesn't really show up in the rankings. But I'm used to seeing the ones that come with the thing that fits in a drill, and you apply your abrasive, and you do the thing with the drill, and then you coat it and do all sorts of, you know, just wrap it up. This one doesn't have that. They're saying Sylvania's headlight restoration kit.
And this is the one you use, the Sylvania
No,
kit?
No, this is the one that the editors like, and I've never even seen it. It doesn't look like it has a drilling attachment. It's a three-step kit that comes with a surface activator, a clarifying compound, and a UV-blocking clear coat. Rubber gloves, sandpaper, and some cloths are also included. You'll need your own masking tape, however.
Or just pull the headlight out of the car.
Because, you know, you can't get everything.
Does it come complete with elbow grease?
I actually know somewhere where you can buy elbow grease.
Nice.
So with enough to restore two headlights, the company also says it can be done in just 30 minutes, but then there's the other ones, including the ones that Becca's mentioned before. Like, I got Mother's New Lens and used that.
That's what I was going to ask. Where does yours fall in on the ranking on that website? Is Mother's on there?
Mother's is the second one they mentioned. And Meguiar's is the third one.
I was about to say, I grabbed Meguiar's. Now, Meguiar's has different stages, and the one that I had grabbed was the heavy duty.
Yeah.
I just cut right to the chase. You know, I was done with all the DIY stuff. I was ready for the lights to work better.
There's two things, right? It's like the kind that comes with the drill and an abrasive, and then the other kind that just wipes on. Like there's a company that's simply called Wipe New, or a product that's simply called Wipe New.
I think I've vaguely heard of that. I haven't seen it in stores. I think it might have been an on-TV thing.
Yeah.
As seen on TV.
Yeah.
But these people say, in fact, I'm just going to plagiarize them and read them. It says, the package promises clear headlights in just seconds, and that one application will last years. A few users says it did not work for them at all.
So it's just wipe on, though?
It looks like it.
So there's no UV protection. It just wipes it away and doesn't.
Yeah, that's right.
Some marketing chick in some room somewhere got paid a lot to write that.
I think that's right.
Yeah.
Then there's the 3M kit, which also has a drill, and Rain-X. Rain-X has a headlight restorer that comes with abrasives, but nothing that attaches to a drill.
Rain-X has gone downhill over the years. Where is 3M at?
3M is just below the Meguiar's kit.
So what, 4?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Because I've always kind of respected 3M as far as certain products for a car.
It's probably splitting hairs, right, between the Mothers, the Meguiars, and the
Mothers and Meguiars seem to be right in line with each other,
right,
from my experience. It just, whatever is in their product line, I love both companies.
So then the other things on the list, the notable ones that I want to mention is Turtle Wax actually makes one, and Duplicolor, a spray paint that you can find in Home Depot and Walmart, of all people, they actually sell a headlight restoration kit that comes in a spray can.
No,
I'm not going to go there. No. But I'm bringing all this up because I've used the Mother's one to great effect on a number of different headlights. And I want to invite our listening audience to chime in if they've ever used anything and if they find that there's a favorite of theirs out there that they would recommend. So please find us online at our website, thethingaboutcars.com, or on our Facebook page, The Thing About Cars, and let us know what you like and what works for you. And yes, Becca?
No, I was just, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to make you stop in mid-sentence there. I just was going to mention, since we're plugging brands anyways, a little away from cars probably, if we're buying things that attach to power drills, Dremel now has, and you're going to think I'm weird for this one.
We already think you're weird, Becca.
Thank you. I take that as a compliment.
Right on.
I love Dremel.
Yeah.
I'm choking up Leanne, apparently. They now have a tool out that's marketed towards cleaning. So scrubbing your bathtub, basically.
Right.
It's something like $48, $49 down at Home Depot, and it's going to be a basic palm sander. It doesn't have multiple speeds like your fancy ones, but if you're looking for something that doesn't cost starting at $100, it's actually a great little thing to buy that you can use for headlight restoration kits. Easier to hold on to than if you've got a big old cordless hand drill or whatever to attach to the Dremel. Hand scrubber. I'm making hand things because I can't think of what to call it. It's got a name. It's it's a Dremel thing, you know, the doohickey. Do what?
A buffing pad.
Well, it's not a palm sander. It's made to scrub. It's made to clean.
Yes.
But I've noticed the RPMs are lower than your typical Dremel. And
Oh, no. I have a random orbital palm sander at home that puts my Dremel to serious competition.
Really?
It's extremely fast.
I would think that would give you some burn on your car.
Well, I wouldn't use it on my car.
Well, I'm talking about car palm sanders.
Yeah, I get it, but yeah.
So
I might use it on a headlight, though.
Well, there you go. There you go. I wouldn't want to burn the plastic on the headlight either, but.
Mm-hmm. All right, so next topic on the board. Moneyballing of NASCAR.
Yeah.
What are we talking about there?
Do you all remember the movie Moneyball?
Yes.
Brad Pitt. It was all about the economics of baseball. Mm-hmm. And the way they valued players.
Mm-hmm.
And the goal there, the summary was, it wasn't about buying a player, it was about buying runs. That was the theory there. You bought runs, and in order to do that, you buy hits.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came up with a valuation system of players that was uniquely different. Mm-hmm. And it took out all the bias of things like, oh, he's handsome and good-looking, and of course he's a star. You know, or he's a little goofy and, you know, not going to be popular.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
So the Moneyball of NASCAR, there's a guy that's kind of done the same thing. The software is now set so that it can compulate and deliver to the guy on the pit stand 1,000 scenarios of when the yellow might fly, so what you should do in the next pit stop, 2 tires, 4 tires.
Mm-hmm.
And it's based on the historic of numbers of yellow. So if you were watching the IndyCar races on ABC last year, you occasionally got the Scott Goodyear, after he talked about the weight jacker endlessly, use your weight jacker tools. We made a drinking game out of that.
I'm sure.
But he would talk about, oh, our engineer analysis says there's a 32% chance that we're going to have a yellow in the next 10 laps. Well, it's that software, but it's on steroids, and it's now giving them statistical analysis on making the call in the pit road as opposed to going with your gut, and that's kind of interesting.
So it's like actuarial for racing.
Yeah.
Statistics and probability.
That's actually pretty mind-boggling.
It is. Yeah. It's actually, you know, okay, so that good guttural guy, I mean, this is where the pinnacle of the sport vastly differs from, you know, late model. But, it's interesting how that's going to do. Or when Tony Stewart's team all suited up, all four of them ran together as a team, and then they zooked it out amongst themselves in the last lap. I mean, that's a strategy.
Yeah.
It's a team strategy, but what does it actually do for the spectator? How does it make the racing? Does it make it more interesting or not? Does it take an element of the driver out? These are the burning questions of the who wants to know kind of thing.
Right. So what do you do about it?
Good question.
Yeah.
I think that's a really good question for Richard Buck, head of competition. You know, do you make it a rules thing? Do you navigate it out of the sport? Do you allow it to infiltrate in? I think that that's an interesting call. You know, I figure anybody who pays NASCAR for any type of rules value is actually going to get it done. So, I mean, that's you know, how you do that. So,
right.
Thus the McLaren EFIs, that still baffles me. All of the stock car EFIs are one McLaren. There's an F1 McLaren EFI on every single NASCAR car. And it's like, what? Were you too lazy in the rules department to actually, you know, check the Toyota version, the Ford version, or whatever? I mean, unfortunately, we're not. All the guys that are in competition heading for NASCAR actually came out of IndyCar. A lot of them are former Penske guys or they're from IndyCar. So the things that IndyCar went through in their specking of the sport, they've actually put NASCAR through quite a bit. There's also a lot of engineering that came into NASCAR, so a lot of the good old boys stuff kind of left, you know, stock car racing.
Yeah.
And that's kind of one of those ways that you see that. But I frankly was, I hadn't been back in the NASCAR garage area in quite some time until about 2 years ago, and I thought, EFI McLaren in NASCAR. That's a jacket that you just don't really see. You're not going to see Jack Daniels and a McLaren logo on the same shirt.
Right.
It's
right.
Just not going to work.
It's too funny.
So.
Ben, you have any thoughts on the matter?
Not really. This time will tell.
Can of worms.
Yeah, see how it comes out.
I mean, that's the thing, though. I mean, you notice something's going on, and do you let things shake out with time, or do you raise a flag and say, oh, something needs changing over here?
Raise a flag.
That's what I think.
Well, and of course, then all the players involved are saying, as long as that's a checkered flag.
Well, okay, speaking of McLaren, let's move on then. I some time ago, I had made a note to myself to talk about McLaren's weight race. And at the time, CEO Mike Fluitt of McLaren challenged British automakers to focus on saving weight rather than searching for more horsepower. And I wanted to know what you guys thought about this as a company-wide, or and actually an industry-wide suggestion slash challenge. It's is that the right thing to do, saving on weight instead of trying to engineer more horsepower?
Yes.
Yes.
Leanne likes the idea?
I was actually sitting here reading our website.
Becca's so, out.
I'm, yes,
come
I,
back.
I,
come back.
Totally ADHD moment.
Mm-hmm.
Looking at the thing about cars.com. Okay, repeat the statement that they made.
McLaren CEO Mike Fluitt challenged British automakers to focus on saving weight rather than searching for more horsepower.
But can't it be a balance of both?
I mean, obviously. In
I think it
time,
needs
yes.
to be
well,
both. It's finding ways to save it without being crazy, because if you know some of the guys that are doing, like, but, dirt track, they're looking for crazy ways to get rid of weight. But then it's also finding new ways for horsepower, finding ways for more efficiency.
Is this in a racing mode or in a passenger mode?
That's a good question.
Anyway, well, obviously you don't want to do too much weight loss when it's passenger. So good point.
Actually,
well,
depends.
Yeah.
It depends. Well, when let me explain this.
Everybody just squirmed when you said that.
when you're racing, you do things like taking off your rebar. But when you're driving in a passenger car, the rebar might be there to protect you in an accident.
Yeah, but you're now talking about a power-to-weight ratio. So, like, you get into some of the cars today where they have structurally taken out weight from doors, but they still made them structurally sound, okay?
But then so, you see some of them crumbling like a piece of paper.
But for those that get it done correctly, what you're really talking about when you kind of reduce the horsepower to make the horse to power to weight ratio great is you're now taking a opportunity for somebody that shouldn't mash the gas and suddenly get, you know, throw all the rate weight to the rear. That was easy for me to say, weight to the rear, and get themselves in trouble because you've now balanced that. So a lot of people don't need more horsepower. What they need is
right.
to
no,
fit
I'm,
more
I'm not arguing
in
that
the passenger
point, yeah.
And we're at the point now where power is so cheap and so available.
That's
you
the
know,
thing.
Every car being produced now has way more than it needs.
That's exactly right. We're getting and horsepower has always had the headline. Structural engineering and weight has not.
There are a lot of reasons to reduce weight.
That's because it's a Hemi.
You know, yeah. And this is what Colin Chapman was doing, you know, 60 years ago. You know, he was, of course, you know, race it on Sunday, sell it on Monday. He was winning races with cars that had serious power deficits compared to their competitors, but they were light enough to take the turn faster.
But
then, on the road, this has value too. The lighter your everyday car is, the better it does so many things, including not wearing out the infrastructure.
And getting in trouble. Well, that's why we were asking the question, though. Are we talking about racing, or are we talking about on the streets? And we're kind of going back and forth.
Of course, racing,
so that's,
you're really in the same thing. So,
exactly.
So here's a little historic note that was interesting. One of the drivers I had for a while was Andrew Hobbs. Now, Andrew Hobbs is the grandson of David Hobbs. Anytime you get to spend time with David Hobbs, you're in a good day because the guy's just friggin' funny. In fact, he just had a new book come out, Hobbskip. It's really great. So we're having this conversation because IndyCar decided about 2 years ago they wanted to break the speed barrier, the 240-mile speed barrier. I'm thinking this is nuts because you don't drive anything at 240. You point them kind of generally in the right direction.
Right.
Sling it, yes.
But I asked David about it. He says, well, when I was driving for Penske, which is back in the 70s, he goes, we were doing 240 down the front straightaway. And I had a hard time wrapping my brain around that because in our era, in the 2000s, 96 to about 2001, the differential on the overall lap was very small. Mm-hmm. You just didn't get a lot of movement between the corners because obviously we had the ability to go through that and carry the speed. Mm-hmm. Where in when he was running, they were setting the break the 200 mile an hour barrier for the first time. And so the speeds were only at 200 miles an hour, yet they were going 240 down the front straightaway. But because they had no ability to corner whatsoever, they had to drop the speed, get on the binders, get through that corner. And that was a huge difference. But it really floored me when he told me they were doing 240 down the straightaway. In fact, I wanted to question like, Dave, really, David? But, you know, you don't question Hobbs. So he's a funny guy. But I thought that was amazing.
I'm thinking of a meme that I saw that someone posted that was really derogatory towards the smart car. And it showed a picture of a smart car that had been demolished on the road somewhere, and all the panels were gone, the wheels were gone, and it's just basically...
Is that the one with the squirrel? I posted that one.
Yeah, so my comment is, if you'll notice, the cage that holds the passenger is still intact.
Yes.
Right? Everything else fell off the car, but the cage that held the passenger is still intact.
Energy dispersement, which is exactly what we do with IndyCar.
They made those that shape because it was as close to spherical as you could get a car, pretty much.
At the same time, the first time we had Chevy as a sponsor at Sears Point, Earnhardt Sr. was running, and they were going to put the Chevy Metro in as the pace car.
Oh, nice.
And we all just busted and got laughing because we're like...
Did they have to ride their brakes while they were following it?
Well, it was just like, you're going to put him out there, and Sr.'s going to give it a love tap and put a wheel on it. It's going, whee! You can't do it.
Nice.
That's hilarious.
I think I might have mentioned it on a podcast or somewhere. I can't remember if it was recorded or not. I saw an accident with a smart car involved, and the person from the smart car was the only one being loaded in the ambulance.
Yeah.
The other guys were all standing around going, that sucks.
No, it wasn't very smart. Yeah.
Well, to reel it back in, though, I think this is for mass-produced passenger vehicles because the word manufacturers was in that challenge.
Yes.
But also, in that era or in that arena, weight and mass are not everything for safety, even. You don't have to be heavy to be tough. And something if I could retire now, if I had a buck for every time I've recommended somebody look at this, there's a video on YouTube you can see. Is when I think it was NHTSA celebrated their 50th anniversary or something. They took a 2009 Chevy Malibu and a 59 Chevy, I forget the exact model.
Yes.
They did them left front to left front, which is the worst collision. And it's really interesting because the 59 Chevy looks twice as big. They actually weigh within 200 pounds of each other. And watching what happened is really fascinating. And watch the long one that's almost 5 minutes that has all the different slow-mos and angles and things and cameras inside the cars, because the guy in the 09 would have walked away and the guy in the 59 would have been dead.
That's what they said. Everyone in the old car died instantly and everyone in the new car lived.
And this is where lower mass is a good thing in safety as well, because if all the cars are big and heavy, if they're in an arms race to out-heavy each other, that's a lot more mass flying around and bouncing off each other and hitting other things.
But also in the 50s car, there were no seatbelt requirements, there were no airbags, there were no crumple zones.
They used to think it was better to be ejected from the car. Right?
Yeah.
You had a hard metal dashboard. After you crashed, they'd wash your brains off the dashboard and sell the car to the next guy.
Which they didn't do. Well, my thought process just... You know, it's always my Mustang in the back of my brain.
Oh, yeah.
If my Mustang were purely strip, you know, off the road, away from all the crazy people, I would be more than happy to take the rebar off of it, you know, save a whole lot of weight, what have you. But if I've got Joe Blow from Atlanta behind me, I want that rebar back there. So that was just my...
You can jump into my 29 Roadster that absolutely has no seat belts, no roof, no roll cage.
Right.
And Atlanta is like, you know, taking your life in your own hands.
Yes, very much so.
It's really cool to drive, and you'd think I'd be able to get a date from it.
You look great when you die in it.
That's it.
So this begs a question that I wasn't aware that I should be asking, but... right. So we'll just do this very quickly because I know we're running out of time, but... No seatbelts, no airbags, no... Is it street legal to drive, though?
It is, yeah.
Where's the exception that you get for not... I mean, even as a minimum as seatbelts, how do you get past that?
I don't know.
Sick grandfather?
They haven't pulled me over yet.
Yeah.
There you go. It's only illegal if they catch you.
Right, because this equipment was not required in the year of the vehicle's original manufacture.
And that's the one thing. That's the caveat. That's
Okay.
Back in the beginning, they did require some cars to be retrofitted. I don't know how far back they went.
No, I don't think so.
It was an issue with one of my dad's cars.
So even if I buy a 1940s hulk of a car and do ground-up frame-off restoration of it, I'm not required to make it modern.
That's a good question.
As long as it meets the standards of when it was made.
Okay.
At the same time, if I leech onto it and keep it, I'm going to put black Simpson racing belts in this car.
There you go.
Because one, I think it'd be a good look for it, but two, it's just a smart thing to do.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, it just is.
Yeah.
All right, that's all we have time for today. As always, this is The Thing About Cars, recording at Strongbox West Atlanta. Ben, what do we need to tell our friends?
Well, check us out on Facebook, look at our Patreon, check us out everywhere. Spread the word and send us your questions.
And our website address, thethingaboutcars.com.
That's right.
Yes.
Thanks, everybody. We hope you're staying warm and safe out there. We will see you soon.
Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.